Hello, this is Talking to America. I'm your host, Aaron Zellman. We have a special guest today. His name is Robert Meyer. Robert's background is fascinating. Bob is a senior partner in the RMB Group, a commodities and option research and trading team located in Chicago, founded in 1984. He's a trader and analyst for over 25 years. His company specializes in big move, longer term, fixed risk option plays in precious metals, currencies, stock indexes, interest rates such as bonds, and traditional industrial and agricultural commodities. Plus, if that wasn't enough, custom designed precious metal storage and gold interest earning strategies. Bob is a past national director of the Libertarian Party and past marketing and PR consultant of 5 stock commodity exchanges around the world. Bob is project editor for over a dozen investment, privacy, and geopolitical books, and has done extensive writing and speaking on government and emergency controls. His articles and research have appeared in close to 30 investment newsletters and numerous magazines such as Futures, Futures Industry, Wealth, and Barron's. Probably the best part of all is that Bob has worked with JPFO since 1991 and has served on our board of directors since 1994. Today we're visiting with Bob about the economic and political big picture. Finally, I would like to remind you that please remember Bob's opinions are not those of his trading group, and that past market performance never guarantees the future. Bob, welcome to Talking to America.
Glad to be here today, Aaron.
Why don't we get started with what we call the flood of bad news? Fundamentally, what's going on?
Well, I think in the really big picture, what people need to understand is something that is virtually untouched by the popular media, and that is the overarching trend we're dealing with here is a move to fascism. The big picture is that the United States is becoming fascist, and that explains a great deal of the problems and issues we're dealing with today. And that fascism comes from intervention in the economy, what we call Big Mama or Big Papa government, intervention in our private lives, intervention in foreign affairs, and so forth. This isn't fascism with anti-Semitism or jackboots or not yet concentration camps, but rather it's arbitrary intervention where the government disregards for one way or another the Constitution, and it does whatever it thinks is necessary. And that's really what we're talking about. Fascism essentially is a government that can do whatever it thinks is necessary. And the great tragedy and the perverse connotation of this is that virtually all of this has been largely sanctioned by the American voters. And the end result is a classic welfare warfare state, which we have right now. And it's getting more rapacious and will continue to do so, fueled by the current economic emergency, if you will.
Talking about emergencies, what are emergency controls? What kind of controls do you see coming?
When I originally started working on government emergency controls, I was in Washington, D.C., and the list of executive orders was relatively small, and although some of them were quite draconian, but these surfaced in World War I, World War II, during the Korea era, and during Nixon's wage and price controls. And these emergency controls are not rescinded. For instance, the emergency price controls and rationing and various types of travel restrictions imposed by Roosevelt to fight World War II were not repealed until, in some cases, 1953 or 54. So we have this accumulation of executive powers that now effectively allow the president to really do whatever the president wants. The horse is out of the barn. And, of course, they're becoming increasingly pernicious, and the Homeland Security Act and its revisions are the most recent example. It's just, in essence, the result of intervention and the sanction of the general public thinking that they can get something for free, or by surrendering personal liberty, they can make things better. But the axiom stands. You never can ensure your freedoms by surrendering freedoms. And this has been the operative mentality in this country really since the Civil War, when you had your first income tax.
With all that in mind, and a lot of this I think is tied to economics, where does the economy stand?
Well, what we're experiencing now, although a lot of people still don't admit it, is we are in the middle of a massive deflation, perhaps the most massive deflation the country will or has experienced. And what that means is that in real dollar terms, things are getting more expensive. Dollars or cash are worth more and things less. In an inflation, it's just the opposite. Now, what we're trying to do now is inflate out of this massive deflation by making direct additions to the money supply and also by dropping interest rates, as Japan did in the early 1990s when they went into a deflation. The trouble is that doesn't necessarily work. You may be trying to restart an economic engine that's not ready to restart. In the last 6 months or so, many major industrial economies worldwide are down up to 70%, and you have numerous commodities that are well below their price of production. And interestingly enough, you just recently had gasoline prices fall on an inflation-adjusted basis to about 10 cents a gallon, or what they were during World War II. Now, these extremely depressed prices give you the potential for explosive bear market rallies that can suck people in just as the deflation resurfaces and pulls markets even lower than they were when the rallies started. Now, there's this tragic hope that all these government programs, starting with the $70 billion bailout, will salvage the situation. And the simple way to think about this is imagine someone with a treatable cancer, and the person feels bad. So the doctor keeps giving him aspirin and keeps giving him painkillers. And so for a while, the patient feels better, but he's got serious problems. And nothing happens. He keeps going along, more aspirin, more painkillers. But every time he has a rebound, it's worse, and it's more painful and more dangerous. Well, deflation is the attempt of the economy to purge excesses and bring price relationships, including proper relative investment incentives, such as in real estate, back into line and normalized, and to cast off all these artificial drugs and pep pill injections of money and subsidies that the government has laid on the economy. And so the deflation itself is in its own way much like a body trying to cure itself, but the government is not letting that take place, or it would be like a doctor saying, I'm not going to let you go to the hospital of deflation where the cures can be found, which is falling prices, consolidations in businesses, and so forth. I'm going to make you just keep taking aspirin until you die, and effectively that's what the government is doing. Will the $70 billion do it? Absolutely not. A safe bet is, at the very least, it will be four or five times that, say about $4 trillion if they're lucky. And relative to that $4 trillion, please remember that when we started with Bear Stearns some months ago, the total stated estimate to pull the country out of this emerging recession was just $200 billion. And now, of course, we have everyone lining up for a government handout. So everyone is back in line to get more of these temporary feel-good drugs, which in essence are free government money. It's a very tragic situation. The economy would already be pulling out of this problem. It would already have purged and eliminated tremendous inefficiencies. But what the government is doing, because everybody wants that free lunch, is they're saying, well, what we're going to do is not let the market eliminate the inefficiencies. Rather, we're going to subsidize the inefficiencies so they can keep going. And the classic example of that would be the automakers. In Japan, they lowered interest rates virtually to zero, what we're doing here now. And it took close to 20 years in many sectors to get that deflation out of the Japanese economy, where they were subsidized industries and so forth. And this, it's been the same case here. The Great Depression that lasted, say, from 29 to 1939, 1940, would have been over in 2 to 3 years rather than a decade plus if the government had stayed out of it and let the free market work through and adjust price levels. The classic example and the most powerful example of how destructive to the long-term economy are these current government bailouts is the study between the Great Britain and Germany after World War II and the Marshall Plan. The Germans essentially totally freed up their economy, received about $1.5 trillion in Marshall Plan subsidies to get back on their feet, and they had a free market model with minimal government intervention. The British got almost twice as much money, and it was a country that wasn't bombed into rubble like Germany, but they used this socialist interventionist command and control model we are using now, and they did not recover from that wartime recession and malaise until the Thatcher years in the 1980s. And 10 years after Germany started in 45, it was a major world economic power. So what is being done now by way of these bailouts, the $700 billion, or ultimately what absolutely I cannot imagine it going under $4 trillion, and I'm starting to see that number more and more, will in fact poison and debilitate the economy even more.
Let's assume that the aspirin works one more time. What happens when the massive injection of virtually free money to banks, subsidies, and expanded government programs wears down?
The best guess at this time would be a classic stagflation like we saw in the early 70s or early 80s and late 70s. You would continue with pockets of recession or depression, abnormally high economic volatility, but coupled with up to double-digit inflation and interest rates that would tend to collapse or undermine the integrity of the bond and the mortgage markets. We need to bear in mind how vulnerable we are. A country like China owns about $1.3 trillion of our government debt. If they see this stagflation coming, as interest rates go up, they're going to lose on the value of their bonds, which have to fall to adjust. They could sell a very small percentage of that right now, and they could put our mortgage rates at 10 to 12% in a matter of days. And I would not expect a repeat of 1987, where you had a very sharp drop and a very sharp recovery. The debt structure and all sorts of other factors are totally different at this time.
Why don't we move on to a subject that's near and dear to a lot of people, the U.S. dollar.
Well, the dollar is justifiably disparaged because of our prolific spending habits and the fact that we are, in fact, I stress this, the fundamental issue, the grounding issue in all of these discussions is the fact that we are morphing into a classic welfare warfare fascist state. So you need to consider everything within that context. However, within that context, the U.S. dollar is still considered to be a safe haven currency for people in many parts of the world. And what we may very well see is some relative strength in the dollar to continue. It's certainly been performing reasonably well so far. People are bringing home trillions of dollars to pay debts, people who had invested abroad. And, of course, when they bring the dollars back, the exchange rate increases the dollar in value because they're selling foreign currencies and buying the dollar. However, we're also seeing the start of what are called competitive devaluations. As foreign trade volume falls off, countries like Russia and China have just devalued as much as 20% to stay more competitive in these export markets, and I would expect that ultimately the U.S. will attempt to drop the dollar as well. The lower they drop the dollar, the better the gold price will go. It's one of the most perfect inverse correlations in economic history. So the dollar, weaker on balance, but short-term and on a periodic basis, a lot stronger than most people might think.
This is Talking to America. Our guest today is Robert Meyer, a trader and analyst for many years, specializing in big move financial aspects. Bob, as long as we're talking about currency, how about the euro?
The euro currency is the third attempt in about 150 years to create a unified European currency where you would have multiple countries using the same currency. And the track record of currency unions is not good, and the reason is that you're trying to put under the roof of one currency with one uniform monetary policy many diverse economies and cultures and spending patterns within government, and they tend to break down over time. And there's a host of technical indicators that now suggest the euro, which many people thought would replace the dollar, is in fact starting to crumble. And when these currencies start moving back to their prior national currencies, it probably will be gradual, but on balance will help currencies such as the dollar or the Chinese yuan, and may very well expedite global stagflation as these currencies inflate to prop up their economies as they lose the relative advantages of a single currency. But the member infighting already among the 20-plus euro bloc currencies is really becoming very significant. And the wild card there is the growth of the Islamic population in within the euro community. You have now about 50 million Muslims in these euro bloc areas, and without taking sides on that fact, it's intensely disruptive, and it's going to become increasingly so. You have countries like Belgium, Holland, and the Netherlands, where the most common boy's name right now is Mohammed. And you have countries like Holland where people are leaving effectively as refugees because of the influx of Islamic peoples. So you add that, overlay that pressure with the inherent illegitimacy of a monetary union to begin with, and you can see where Europe itself, on balance, will probably become relatively weaker, much more uncertain politically, and much more compliant when it comes to threats to national integrity and their personal freedoms. As a welfare bloc, they're much more advanced than the United States, but we're also catching up quickly.
How long do you think these bad times are going to last?
Again, I think it'll be much longer than people think because of the staggering increase in government intervention in this recession slash depression. And I just was at a major conference with about probably 30 analysts and economists speaking. There was sort of a consensus that late next fall or winter, we would start to see measurable recoveries starting in the stock market and real estate and so forth. But based on what I'm seeing in the commodity markets and based on what I'm seeing globally, where you have even more severe situations than the United States and the repatriation of foreign investment dollars from the United States as well, I think that this recovery is going to take longer. I would not surprise me to see a traditional recovery that would require anywhere from 3 to 5 years, and that's basically the way we're trading in our company, under the assumption that the recovery is going to be much longer than people think. And in certain categories, say commercial real estate, and regionally in private real estate and condominiums, it would not be out of line to forecast 6 to 10 years of underperformance and chronic low sales. And again, this is because the government's getting involved and it's subsidizing the patient's cancer with PEP pills and aspirin and all sorts of temporary measures that don't allow the body, as it were, the economy, to cleanse itself of these fundamental problems through recession and deflation and making the inefficient and the otherwise misallocation of capital go away through bankruptcy, sales, and consolidation. So I think that we're looking at a very unusual business cycle here, and I think it's going to be ugly, and I think it's going to last, as I say, a lot longer than is sort of the conventional wisdom at that time.
Would you say that when our new president, Obama, talked about the need for change, to quote him, he's talking about the stuff in your wallet?
If you sort of look at the psychology of what, for instance, I see in Chicago with the proliferation of Obama posters in store windows and the proliferation of Obama buttons being worn by city employees even now, and the media intensive celebration of Obama even now with like special commemorative editions of newspapers and so forth, I think that there's a situation building, and that is that I think they're building Obama into a messiah. I think that it's very clear. I've never seen this before, and I've been involved in politics professionally since 1974. And when this messiah all of a sudden fails to deliver, which is basically, I think, baked in the cake, and I'm not saying that because he's a Democrat. I think the situation would be the same for McCain. When these things aren't delivered, I think the level of expectation is so high that really for the first time, in my considered opinion, you're laying the groundwork for what could be some rather serious social disruptions.
Along those lines, although a little different, the housing market, I mean, this seems to be disrupting a few people's lives. Do you have any comments on that?
The housing market was built on a false premise that did not become popular until really the 1920s, and that was that everybody, no matter who they were, needed and deserved their own home, and that that own home would ultimately prove to be their best investment. None of that is historically true, yet everyone bought into it, and they bought into it with an awful lot of credit, which now came to a head as the subprime crisis. And again, the real estate market, I was told in politics when I first started out that there was two things that the government would do whatever was necessary to stop. And I was told this by a professional campaign manager who actually worked very actively with Barry Goldwater, and he told me in sort of a training session, he was hired for me and others to train us at the Libertarian Party. He said that there are two things that the government will do anything to stop, no limits. One is a housing collapse, and the second would be a collapse in Social Security. And I think what you're seeing right now is the government fulfilling that projection made by this campaign specialist to me many years ago. There is nothing they will not do in an attempt to stop the fall in housing prices. And that includes, again, very almost quasi-militaristic efforts and controls, and all those are in place. They're there. Barack Obama does not have to really do an awful lot except go to his card file and look at the emergency presidential powers that are already there.
What do you think the odds are of him doing something like that, or else being forced to do something like that?
Well, they approach 100%.
Well, that's encouraging.
No, I really believe, I'm not trying to be flippant in saying that. At the expense of risking redundancy, I would like to reiterate to listeners that one must stop and think carefully about the transition in this society over the last 30 or 40 years and play that wonderful game, which is to sit down with a bunch of old cronies or friends who are at least middle-aged or whatever and start playing the game of what could we do 40 years ago we can't do now? And then just start listing those things. And it goes on for pages. I wrote very, very detailed special reports on emergency controls and actually did a traveling workshop and executive briefing on emergency controls in the early 90s to mid-90s. I could not give that program today because everything I talked about and or forecast is now integral to our daily lives. This is really a pernicious and staggeringly dangerous trend we're talking about here. There is nothing they will not do, and they do not have any constraints on their ability to do whatever they want to do.
Would you be willing to speculate on some of the things they might be willing to do that would actually shock people?
I'll preface that by saying the stock market is, in some respects, the key. We have the S&P down 45%. It's not out of line to expect the S&P ultimately to be down 70%, as this chronic deflation is made chronic by government policies, not allowing the economy to cleanse itself. And if we see that kind of action, bear in mind the NASDAQ was down over 80% with the tech stock bubble. You had mutual fund groups like Fidelity, the Fidelity sector funds that went from $2.5 billion, let's say, in the mid-80s up to close to $31 billion at the top of before the NASDAQ tech wreck started. And within a year or a year and a half, the NASDAQ was back down, or the Fidelity funds were back down around $3 billion. Well, if we see that, the whole retirement plan issue, which is already a shambles, given that about 40% of the population has no health insurance or any sort of retirement plan, you're going to see what I first projected in 1991, which is a raid on retirement plans. You have about $17 trillion in IRAs, KEOs, and defined benefit plans. And I forecast, not that I'm that great a savant, I mean, there were other economists who said the same thing, that if we get this kind of recession and depression, the one we have right now, the odds are really overwhelming that the government will essentially confiscate that $17 trillion, just like Argentina did about a month ago with their retirement plans. What they're going to tell the public is, of course, we're not stealing your plan. You just have to put 50% in a special 30-year emergency, what I called Americana recovery bond, or your total plan will be immediately taxed at regular rates. And this will be a way for them to scoop up all this money to finance even more interventions and yet avoid the accusation, the direct, accurate accusation that they're stealing people's retirement plans. They'll just call it a diversion of equity within the plan to preserve America, which ultimately, of course, will be in the interest of all retirees. And you have two bills pending in the Senate right now, which in one way or another relate to this kind of emergency power. And then one might say, well, what about the outrage, the general American public? This kind of grab, effectively a $8 trillion grab of people's life savings. Well, don't count on any outrage, because the general American public has already sold its soul and freedom heritage for what's commonly called a mess of government pottage or stew. And bear in mind, you've got these millions and millions of people who have nothing, so they look at this as a veritable feast. They look at someone who says, let's save $1 million over a lifetime in these tax-deferred plans. And they see the government taking half that plan and dishing it out to the public at large, the great unwashed. Well, there's going to be no outrage there. There will be applause. And I think it's looking more and more like, to some appreciable degree, they're going to do just that.
Please go to part two to hear the conclusion of this conversation between your host, Aaron Zellman, and our special guest, Robert Meyer.